Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Coming to you from the Toby Family Auditorium at the Commonwealth Club, it's Week to Week, the political roundtable for Thursday, May 23rd, 2019. I'm John Zipperer, your host. I'm sort of rendered speechless by some of what I was watching in the news today, so I'm really going to get to our two panelists today as soon as possible. Just briefly, today we're going to talk about the presidential candidates who are going to be flooding San Francisco next week, the abortion bill politics, Congress versus the president, and more. And of course, we'll end our evening together with our week-to-week live news quiz. Everyone, of course, is welcome at the Commonwealth Club, doesn't matter what your views are, but any opinions that are expressed up here are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Now, let's meet our panelists for today. On the far end of the stage is Dan Schnurr. He's a professor at the University of Southern California Annenberg School of Communications. He's on Twitter at Dan Schnurr. So welcome back, Dan. Next to me is Carla Marinucci. She's a senior writer at Politico California Playbook. She's on Twitter at CMarinucci. So.
You know that Carla's loved because they didn't even wait for the introduction to be finished before they started clapping.
Carla's back.
Okay.
And I should note, our third panelist, Dr. Larry Gersten, had to cancel at the last minute. He is a bit under the weather, so we wish him the best, and we look forward to having him back soon. You all know how we do this program. There are question cards throughout the room. Write out some questions. People will deliver them to me, and I'll try to work them into our conversation here tonight. Now, on to our roundtable, and I'm not even going to start with that whole rose garden thing. We'll get to that.
Let's go there.
Let's start kind of more locally, and that is next weekend, the final weekend of the month, there's going to be the state Democratic convention. It's going to take place about a mile from here over, I believe, at Moscone.
That's right.
And there are going to be a lot of presidential candidates showing up. It's going to attract them like, I guess, a slab of raw beef at a picnic. This attracts flies. I don't know. So, Carla, so will state daughters and sons, favorite sons and daughters, that is, Eric Swalwell.
That's right.
Kamala Harris.
Marianne Williamson.
Marianne Williamson. How are they going to do with this? Are they going to be the most popular people there or not?
Not necessarily. I mean, you're going to have 14 presidential candidates in town. They're going to be throwing elbows. There's national media is going to be all over the place here because the California Democratic State Convention is the largest state convention in the country. There's 500 delegates at stake here in California. This is the place where these candidates are going to get to reach the boots on the ground people, the most energized people. The problem for these candidates is the California Democratic Party is far to the left, probably, of the general electorate. So that's where I think Kamala Harris and some of the other candidates are going to have an interesting time because Bernie Sanders is going to be in town. He's got a very big and energetic following. Joe Biden is not coming so far.
Oh, he's not.
Yes. And there's a lot of what I'm hearing from some of his people out there is that, look, this is Kamala's home turf. These people are way to the left. They're not exactly a Joe Biden crowd. Remember, this is the same state party that endorsed Kevin DeLeon over Dianne Feinstein. But Feinstein has regularly gotten booed at this thing. People like Joe Lieberman and John Kerry have gotten booed here. So we're going to see some interesting stuff coming down next week when they're all here. They're not only doing stuff at the Moscone Center, they're doing a big move-on event at the Warfield Theater. And I'm going to be interested to watch, how the Bernie people organize, how organized they are, how big that contingent is. I'm also going to be interested to watch Pete Buttigieg, because I've now covered him a couple of times here in San Francisco, including at the Commonwealth Club. Just a couple of weeks ago, he did a big rally here on Van Ness, a $25 head rally, which, who does that anymore? And there were 1,300 people there. Some of the people at his event were Kamala Harris people, her finance people. Leslie Katz was there. Bevin Dufty was there. And I said, what are you all doing here? And they said, well, we've donated to Pete too. Pete is taking a little bit of the fire from Kamala. So I think it's going to be an interesting thing to watch. And the reason that California is so important is because you all are going to start voting the same week they start voting in Iowa. It really is sort of an early primary. The primary is March 3rd, but remember, we start voting 30 days before that, and that tracks it right around the same time as the Iowa caucuses. So as much as they think Iowa and New Hampshire think they may be first in the nation, California's up there too, and that's all these campaigns have told me. They're watching that. They need to have traction in California. They need to have a play here. But the progressive side of the Democratic Party is going to be a problem for some of them.
I mean, Carla's exactly right, and you can broaden her point. Conventions almost by definition attract the most ideologically extreme members of both parties. It takes a lot more energy and a lot more enthusiasm to take your time to go to a convention center, to put on silly hats and to scream and yell for someone than it takes to fill out a ballot. And so consequently, Democratic conventions tend to be much more progressive than Democratic voters as a whole, just like Republican conventions tend to be a lot more conservative. So Biden is making the very, very smart decision. As the designated centrist, maybe not in the race, there's a few others among the 23, but among the designated centrist in the top tier, the worst place in the world for him to be next weekend would be on stage at the Moscone Center, because this is not a crowd that, no matter what he tells them, would receive him pretty well. Very well. I feel like Kamala Harris faces a real challenge, not just here, but more broadly, given the positioning that Carla was talking about. The Atlantic magazine last week ran a piece that referred to her as the Jan Brady of the Democratic primary. And so for some of the younger people in the audience, we should stop and explain who Jan Brady is. I think for some of the younger people, we should explain what a magazine is. But that's a conversation for another day. And what Harris is trying to do, and if she pulls it off, it's masterful, but it's tricky. Running in the I'm progressive, but not quite as progressive as Sanders or Warren Lane is a pretty intricate path to follow. And going forward, if you look at her candidacy, her best moments by far, and you could argue the best moments, not just for Harris, but for any Democratic candidate, have occurred for her when she has sat on the rostrum of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Yeah.
With Jeff Sessions, with Brett Kavanaugh, with others in front of her. And I think what needs to happen for her campaign to return to the stage where it was when she entered the race is to figure out how to move that forcefulness from the committee room to the campaign trail. The convention is an opportunity to do it. We'll see if she does. Lastly, although I agree with Carla on 97 out of 100 things that she says, there is one thing that we disagree on. I don't think the California primary is going to matter even as much as it did 4 years ago, but we can come back to that.
Oh, I'd like to hear more about that at some point. But let's talk about some of the other 8,000 candidates who are in the race. I guess we had New York Mayor Bill de Blasio. Well,
if we do 45 seconds on each, we will run out of time before we give away the prizes.
This is one of the reasons Joe Biden isn't coming, by the way. Yeah. Each of these candidates is going to get 7 minutes to speak in front of this crowd.
So it's presidential speed dating.
This is going to be crazy to watch. Of course, they're going to all these caucus rooms and doing these parties and so forth and looking for money while they're here. You know, Cory Booker's doing a big fundraiser down in L.A. the day before. He's got all kinds of Hollywood stars there. But the bottom line is, as you said, they're also going to have to discuss some of their issues in front of this very progressive crowd. And remember, Kamala Harris, she got in trouble in the very beginning saying, oh, we may have to do away with the private insurance companies to get Medicare for all, right? That kind of thing, they're going to be asked. Bernie Sanders is going to be asked about, should the Boston bomber, a marathon bomber, be voting in prison? The kind of thing that a lot of more moderate Democratic voters are maybe cringing at, right?
John, I know we have a lot of topics to cover, but I think it's worth taking an extra minute on this because Carla's making a really important point. And once again, I'd broaden it because to me, and I'll be very eager to hear your thoughts on this, Carla, the split in the Democratic Party that exists right now is not just a classic ideological liberal versus centrist split. That, to me, at least what I observe from the safety of my no party preference perch, is that there's sort of a meta question to be resolved in the Democratic primary between now and hopefully next June, but perhaps next July or August, we'll see. Some of you may remember, if you're Netflix fans, there was a TV show on Netflix a few years ago called Bloodline with Kyle Chandler and with Linda Cardellini. And we decided to watch it because one day I was driving home from campus in Los Angeles, and where we live, we see billboards for the TV shows and movies because they think everyone in LA, you know, votes in the Oscars and Emmys. And there was a billboard up for Bloodline, and the tagline on it was, "We're not bad people, we just did a bad thing." Now that was enough to get me to watch the pilot episode, and ended up being a 3-year series, and it's great, by the way. So the reason I bring this up is, think about this. We're not bad people, we just did a bad thing. I would suggest to you that is Joe Biden's rationale for candidacy in this race. On balance, Biden and others, Booker, Steve Bullard, Amy Klobuchar, and others said, look, we're good people. We as a country, we make mistakes. We've done bad things in the past. We try to fix them. We're not perfect, but on balance, the trajectory of our country is a positive one. We did something really bad 3 years ago. Let's fix it and let's get back to normal. That's the Biden, Klobuchar, Booker end of this. The Warren Sanders end of this is much more dramatic. And Sanders himself says, this isn't just about replacing Donald Trump. This is about fundamentally remaking our country. And that is either a much more dramatic and expansive or a much more radical and revolutionary approach. I think what Democrats have to decide between now and next year's primaries is which of those broader philosophies, which has really not that much to do with liberalism or centrism, but which of those broader philosophies seems like a better path forward. Is it a more measured one, whether it's centrist or liberal, or is it a more dramatic one, whether it's from the left or from the center?
I think this is, you've got it exactly right. And this is where Kamala Harris has a challenge, because what is her lane? As you said, she's been so strong on the Judiciary Committee. By the way, she picked up, I think, almost $1 million in fundraising after she made those very strong statements about abortion, the Alabama abortion law. I know we're going to discuss that. So she's had some moments, but at the same time, she's had challenges with these other candidates getting into the race and kind of peeling off some of her voters. So this is the issue. I don't think the California primary in any way is a slam dunk for her. I think when you look at the kind of competition she has on every level and on every issue, whether it's for African American voters or women voters, or she's got to craft a campaign that keeps her up. Right now, I think she's considered in the top tier. But she's going to have to fight to stay there. Yeah.
And to be fair to her, the reason she's facing these kind of questions is because she entered the race as such an explosive force. No one was asking, why didn't John Hickenlooper take a more forceful position on issue X, Y, and Z? Yeah, right. Harris, just by the amount of attention she attracted at the beginning, therefore gets more scrutiny.
Well, and what do you think about the complaining that some of the supporters of Klobuchar, Gillibrand, and Harris have made about, we're U.S. senators, we've got real accomplishments, and why is this mayor of Northwest
South Bend, Indiana,
some town in Indiana, is he getting all this attention and love? But he, on the other hand, he has handled himself very well.
Having now talked to him 2 times, and he's a very, I haven't seen a candidate like him since I've been covering this stuff since 1996, which is just comes off as somebody who is not scripted, is unafraid to talk to the media, unlike Kamala Harris sometimes, and some of these other candidates who will blow past you. They don't like doing these press scrums. He doesn't have a problem doing that. Mm-hmm. And he's got a following out there. I think the authenticity factor has really connected with a lot of people. I was telling you, John, that after his last appearance in San Francisco, the same day that Donald Trump called him Alfred E. Newman, I asked him, what do you think of that criticism? And he said, maybe it's a generational thing. I had to Google who Alfred E. Newman was.
But you know what? It was a light moment, but it was so perfectly calibrated.
Totally.
I think American people, you guys tell me.
Yeah.
It seems to me that we have been watching politicians of both parties at a hair trigger, ready to react and overreact and jump down the other person's throat for so long. It's exhausting.
Yeah.
And for someone like Buttigieg, not to dismiss it, but in a lighthearted but forceful way,
it's
very refreshing.
And it blew me away that after I posted that video, within 48 hours, it got 2.5 million hits. which is just a mind blower. Which, what does that tell you? People are watching what this guy is saying in a way they aren't watching a lot of the other candidates.
So I'll answer your question, John. How did the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, end up in this kind of position and on the cover of Time magazine? Will someone please explain to the young people what Time magazine is? how did he achieve that? He earned it. He went on CNN Town Hall, had an absolute star turn, followed up with several very impressive...
Including the Commonwealth Club. He got a lot of attention here. Yeah.
And so he earned that. He earned the cover of Time, jokes aside, the same way that Elizabeth Warren earned it. You say, I've got a plan for that enough times. Whether people agree with that plan or not, and it's going to impress them. Yeah. And they both of them ended up with that level of attention because they earned it. I won't pick on Kirsten Gillibrand because I think she's a very admirable person. In fact, no one normal has seen it, but she's got a really, really impressive position on campaign finance reform, which I'd encourage you to check out on her website. As smart as she is and as accomplished as she's been in the Senate, she has not yet earned that stature yet the way a Buttigieg or a Warren has. And it doesn't mean that she's a bad person. It just means that she hasn't yet found an opportunity to seize. Mm-hmm. The same way that they
have. And he did the Fox News town hall recently. Another thing.
Which ended with a standing ovation,
which is incredible. So, I mean, why more of these Democratic candidates, including Kamala Harris, don't take that route? I have to say, on the women candidates, too, this is one other thing to watch, and particularly with Kamala. How much are they have now been sort of relegated to, are you going to be the VP for Joe Biden? No. And there is a sexism there. But at the same time, it's been pointed out, watch how much or how little Kamala Harris criticizes Joe Biden, because a lot of people on the Democratic side say that would be the choice for Joe Biden. She checks a lot of boxes for him, a woman of color, she could end up as left, the VP. Yeah. And so whether or not she criticizes him how much at this convention and elsewhere.
This might be unpopular to say, but I think the dynamic that you're talking about, Carla, has more to do with poll numbers than chromosomes. People are asking Cory Booker if he would want to be a running mate. If anybody were to ask John Hickenlooper questions, they would ask him if he wanted to be a running mate or in the cabinet or something like that. Mm-hmm. No one's asking Elizabeth Warren if she's going to be someone's running mate because she's running as a top-tier candidate. Yeah. So I really think that has more to do with standing in the race than it does gender. But I'd offer you this. Think about this for a second. This is the sixth consecutive presidential election in which a woman has run for president. So that itself is no longer as remarkable as it once was. Yeah. That said, this is the first time that women have ever run against each other for president.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Even in 2016, when Carly Fiorina was running on one side and Hillary Clinton was running on the other, they never had a chance to run against each other. They are always the only woman in the race. And I think what's going to be fascinating about this campaign, is it'll allow us to break out of a lot of the conventional wisdom about female candidates, because I think what we've done for the last 5 years or so is taken everything we know about Hillary Clinton and said, well, that's what happens with female candidates. And I don't know you can say that about Hillary Clinton any more than you could have said that about Michelle Bachmann or Elizabeth Dole. And this year, by virtue of several different women running credible campaigns for president, I think we'll get a much better sense going forward of what a female leader's strengths and weaknesses are in this context than we've seen before.
Yeah.
Briefly before we move on, someone in the audience writes, JFK was a Catholic, Mayor Pete has a husband, neither was a problem to them. I would, as someone who's native from Wisconsin, the upper Midwest, not too far from where Pete Buttigieg is a mayor, the fact that he is a family man, a Christian, not afraid of talking about it, but also not in your face about it, that goes down well up there.
No, it's interesting. And one of the things I asked him when he was here in San Francisco was, look, as many Democrats like you, they like what you have to say, but is it still a bridge too far for many Democrats to believe a gay married man could be president? And his answer was, I was reelected in Indiana when Mike Pence was governor with 80% of the vote. Of course, yes, South Bend, Indiana. But the fact is, maybe we're getting to a place where,
Well, this is not me saying that Mayor Buttigieg will not be elected president in 2020, because as those of you have heard me talk before, know that I gave up on making political predictions 2.5 years ago for only the best of reasons.
Right.
But while I think the point about Senator, about John F. Kennedy is the right one, it's worth remembering that Al Smith ran for president before John F. Kennedy did, that Jesse Jackson and Carol Moseley Braun ran for president before Barack Obama did. And that's not to say that Mayor Buttigieg will not be elected.
Yeah.
And certainly public attitudes on marriage equality and other LGBTQ issues have progressed much more rapidly than most social and cultural issues over the years. But if he does fall short, if he continues to run a campaign of this nature, that should not be seen as a failure, but rather a tremendous step forward that might not be culminated in 2020 any more than Al Smith's campaign exactly 100 years ago culminated in success. But it is worth noting that sometimes these things do take a little bit of time.
Yeah. Well, briefly, before we move on to our next topic, someone asks, who will be the first five or six candidates to drop out? For the first couple you think will be drop out?
First five or six?
Just a couple. Who are the first couple?
Well, I mean, I think Eric Swalwell is kind of interesting because I he's speaking here next month, by the way. There's been a lot written about will he hold on to a seat. Now there's people even starting to run for his seat. I really don't believe he's going to give that seat up. I don't think he's going to give it up. I think eventually he will drop out. But that's, I think you're going to see a lot of the minor. I think Gillibrand is another example of somebody who might drop out. She doesn't have, at least the last time I checked, no endorsements from anyone in her own state, which I think is a telling factor.
The real, this is mean, but I can't think of another word at the moment.
Yeah.
The real bottom feeders don't have a reason to drop out. It's fun. You get to go to Iowa, New Hampshire, and people talk to you, and they stick microphones in your faces, and you get to pretend that you might be president someday. So you've got nothing to lose. You just stick with it. Kirsten Gillibrand, who, if she does not find that moment we were talking about a little bit earlier, if she does not find that moment, she still has a really potentially very impressive political future. Yeah. And saving that might encourage her.
I think what Donald Trump did is make this into a marketing opportunity. Essentially, it's a branding opportunity. And that's why I think you have some of these folks who might never have gotten in otherwise.
The others I'd watch very carefully, we'll call it the Schumer primary. Chuck Schumer wants the Senate back and he wants it badly. And it'd be a lot easier if Beto O'Rourke was running for Senate in Texas and if Steve Bullock was running for Senate in Montana and a couple of others. So unlike people who continue to run because it's fun, for those who live in states with a Republican senator up for reelection, there's going to be extraordinary pressure on them to rethink it. So I suspect those might be the ones who go first.
Okay, very good. President Donald Trump announced that he plans to cancel $1 billion in funds for California's high-speed rail project, which was recently truncated by a surprise decision by California Governor Gavin Newsom. Dan, California is suing to stop the loss of that money. Do they have a case or is it a lost cause?
You know, in most of these disputes, I can find someone to root for. This one is a lot tougher. First of all, I think like most people, I love the idea of a high-speed rail. I love the idea of what many of us voted for a decade ago, a $9 billion expenditure that would whisk us from San Diego to the Bay Area and back 2 hours and 45 minutes each way. To be fair to the federal government, that's not what the Newsom administration is now working toward. The governor himself created a little bit of confusion about this in his State of the State address when he said there is, quote, no path to that kind of high-speed rail. And many people, myself included, took that to mean that he thought there was no path to that kind of high-speed rail. He's backtracked on it somewhat and said we're going to build the Central Valley leg first and then someday finish the rest.
Someday when I'm
so
long out of government.
If I were his lender, whether the federal government or just somebody much wealthier than I'll ever be, to say, hey, wait, I gave you a few billion dollars for a Southern California to Northern California rail. That's not what you're building. Give me my money back, and then let's start a new negotiation about whether the federal government should give you some money for a Central Valley rail. And I'd hope, particularly with a House Speaker and a minority leader in the House who are from California, there would be some funds for a shorter, more purposeful rail from Bakersfield to Merced. But I think it is within the rights, that's where it's actually going. But I think it is within the rights of the federal government to say, look, we gave you money for one thing, and just because you're still calling it high-speed rail doesn't mean that you're entitled for it. All that said, as is the case with so many things, I think here's controversy. I think the U.S. embassy in Israel ought to be in Jerusalem. But like so many other things, whether it's an embassy or high-speed rail, the way the administration has handled it, it's a delicate situation, makes it awfully tough to root for them too.
Yeah. But I have to say, I mean, I think in some respects, Gavin Newsom brought this on himself because he gave an opening to President Trump when he delivered the state address and said there was no plan. And the headlines followed him. And now the state is saying this is in retribution for the state of resistance. Gavin Newsom did have a little bit of a victory this week in that he's gotten the federal government to agree not to spend that almost $1 billion on other projects, at least to put a hold on it. But the fact is, this is going to be in litigation, and he, I think, has nobody else to blame for putting the red flag in front of the bull here.
But again, the question is blame, and it goes back to the point that you made a moment ago. No day is a better day for Gavin Newsom when he gets to say something mean about Donald Trump. Except maybe a day when Donald Trump says something mean about Gavin Newsom. Either way, it can galvanize his support in California like nothing else. Yeah. And losing $1 billion for a train might not be that big a deal compared to the fact that he got to have another fight like this with the president of the United States.
Well, another decision the governor made recently was to announce $1 billion to address homeless issues in the state. And I wanted to put this in the context of an article that's kind of gone virally lately from the Washington Post. It was by a writer whose name I apologize. I don't remember off the top of my head, but I mean, it was kind of one in the, and you've probably seen this like genre of writers about just how horrible San Francisco is to live in. It's a total hellhole. It's all gone downhill. It's.
Yeah, no, there's just been a spate of these stories.
Right, it's the cloud living people, and then you have the Morlocks down below.
And not just San Francisco, California in general. Yeah. Terrible place to live. As we were talking, saying, yeah, it's terrible to get up every morning to a crayon blue sky, etc. And those of us who live in California and have been here for a long time know there's challenges here, but at the same time, I mean, really, come on. But the fact is that this homeless issue is the most visible aspect, and that's the one that all of these stories concentrate on, this epidemic of homelessness. And I was in at Gavin Newsom's event in Oakland this week, and he was with Libby Schaft announcing this new plan, this idea to find the best practices around the state. He knows if he doesn't solve this problem, there's two things he's got to solve, and if he can, in 4 years, which is homelessness and the housing issue. Those are the top of mind of people. And this homeless issue is so visible in every major city. And people who come here from other states are shocked. There's many reasons for it. It's not just a California problem. But the fact is there's a whole generation of problems that have built up over the years, including evictions of people. When we had public housing projects, people didn't get evicted as much as they are now. And the fact is, in Section 8 housing, there has been an epidemic of evictions. And the author of a book called Eviction, who won the Pulitzer Prize 2 years ago, laid this all out. The fact is that particularly single Black women are the ones who are most affected by this. And once you're evicted from a Section 8 apartment for, say, calling 911 or calling a plumber, which is what is happening, getting back into housing is almost impossible, and there's no legal help. Well, Newsom has put millions of dollars now into legal help to stop evictions, which I think is a really important thing. But he's now got a task, Daryl Steinberg, who's the mayor of Sacramento, and Mark Ridley Thomas from Los Angeles, to go around the state and find best practices that are going on. And in Oakland, he held this news conference at a place where people come in, they have caseworkers who work with them for 4 or 5 months, and then they are given transitional permanent housing, and they found that, I think they said, 80% of these people never return to the streets. You've got to find some kind of programs like that. We know these navigation centers and other places just are not, a lot of times, just not doing it.
The statistic I saw, and I'm open to anyone who has better statistics on it, but that it was that the navigation center's success rate is 14%.
Yeah. I mean, we know these cities have spent millions and millions of dollars on this and no answer, and the problem's getting worse.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
There's really three aspects of this challenge. The first is mental health, and that is a conversation for another day when there's time and space for it. Second is support and services for the homeless. And that's a conversation I think you were appropriately touching on. The third is increasing the available housing supply. Cool. And I'll tell you, on one hand, I give Governor Newsom tremendous credit on this front. Because Jerry Brown, for all his other accomplishments as governor, was fatalistic almost to the point of dismissive when it came to the question of increasing the housing supply in California. He didn't think the state either could or would be able to make the kind of difference that is necessary. So give Newsom big credit for being willing to take this on in a way that has not been done here in quite some time. That said, this week, Senator Scott Wiener had a seminal bill, and it was not a perfect bill. It certainly had flaws, but it's the most ambitious bill, Senate Bill 50, which would have created a much larger supply of affordable housing, particularly near transit stops and job centers. After the bill died, Governor Newsom said he was disappointed, which is good, but he did not formally endorse the bill before he was disappointed by its lack of passage. And it's worth assuming that if a governor, particularly a very popular governor, does endorse a bill, perhaps it increases the chances of passage and lessens the possibility of disappointment. The real challenge for Newsom, whether it's on homelessness, whether it's on health care, you name the issue, at some point soon, Gavin Newsom needs to slay a dragon. The legislature, the legislators were scared of Jerry Brown. He was sort of the get-off-my-lawn governor, and they were terrified of him. If their ball rolled into his yard, they didn't want any part of it. They're still deciding what to make of Newsom. And he made, I think, a very impressive case in his opening weeks in his State of the State, in his budget, very serious about maintaining reserves. But all of a sudden, now you see the legislators starting to nibble at him. They pushed back against his water tax. This SB 50 housing bill went away. They're beginning to put more money into programs that he had wanted to save in the budget reserves. And I think at a certain point in the not-too-distant future, he's going to have to take a hostage or slay a dragon, whatever the metaphor is, to let the legislature know that when something is really important to him, he's willing to engage that forcefully on it. And as soon as he does that on one issue, I think there'll be a lot more deferential on a lot of other fronts too.
Briefly, before we move on, so SB 50 has basically been, the committee chair said, it's dead for this year, you can bring it up next year. Scott Wiener has said he's going to keep trying even this year. Is it, what do you think the prospects are that we'll see?
There are efforts to try and revive it, and I think Tony Atkins in the Senate has said, this is not a one-size-fits-all issue. She's gotten tremendous pressure for also not standing up for this bill. I think you have to give him credit for trying a very creative approach to a problem that nobody really wants to deal with. I mean, he's not saying that San Francisco is going to turn into Hong Kong, but you're talking about 4- and 5-story buildings in a city where over 70% is zoned for single family housing. This is a very hard lift in every community. I think he's going to come back at it. But whether it's going to be this year, I think most people don't give it a lot of chance to come back soon.
I think that's right. Going back to our conversation about presidential breakthroughs, think of SB 50 as the Al Smith of housing legislation in California, setting the groundwork for a breakthrough rather than being the breakthrough itself. The real challenge for the Democrats on this one is the fiercest opposition, not surprisingly, comes from suburbs. And while the suburbs were once battlegrounds between Democrats and Republicans, the suburban rings in the Bay Area, outside of Los Angeles, outside of San Diego, have become increasingly Democrat. And offending economically successful, socially progressive, wealthy suburbanites is not something most leading Democrats are eager to do. Mm-hmm. So there's going to have to be compromise legislation. Getting it done in the next couple months is going to be tough.
Yeah. Okay. Well, our next topic. So Donald Trump stormed out of a meeting earlier today with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, allegedly upset with Pelosi because she had said he has engaged in a cover-up. Then, sounding nothing like someone who's engaging in a cover-up, he went and told reporters that former FBI Acting Director Andrew McCabe, former FBI Director James Comey, and a former Justice Department official were guilty of treason, a crime punishable by death, by the way. So this is what we're going to talk about for the next 6 hours. Might want to... We'll have sleeping bags and overnight stuff. We've done this so many times over the past couple of years where I brought up one of these issues and just kind of like, never thought we'd see this.
Yeah, no, Carla. I mean, wait, this is one of those where, you know, I've watched a lot of presidential press conferences over the years. This was probably one of the most jaw-dropping ones I've seen for him to, and it just dramatized how much Nancy Pelosi is getting to him. I mean, Christine Pelosi, who's her daughter, you know, she's very active here in San Francisco, has said many times on Twitter, like, don't mess with mama. And it's like, Donald, take her advice. Because he got up there and called her crazy Nancy, said she didn't understand the trade bills, that she's losing it. Basically called her mentally ill and disintegrating in front of our eyes. Just every insults all over the place. It was amazing to watch, but it was an illustration of, he's really freaking out, I think. It looked to me like maybe these issues, Maxine Waters in the Finance Committee, getting a hold of Deutsche Bank and Capital One financial figures, then the tax information. A federal judge decided with basically the Democrats on that. Stuff is closing in on him on the financial stuff, and she just played. She just as she did in that January meeting with him and Schumer on the shutdown, where she came out, you know, a winner there. He has been making the argument that the Democrats have been doing nothing because they're investigating him. And then he basically said, I'm going on strike until you stop these investigations, which, I mean, now he has no one to blame for nothing getting done.
My favorite Pelosi moment so far this year is neither yesterday's or the January summit meetings, but rather the State of the Union address with the seal clap. She really does know how to get under his skin. And the best description I've heard of the president's news conference is, it said it was his Twitter account come to life.
Essentially, yes.
And the raging id venting that he normally does on social media was done in person. All that said, there's an emerging consensus, at least among the people who I read closest and respect the most, that Trump knows what he's doing on this, and that he very specifically has decided that he's going to do everything he can to goad the Democrats into impeaching him, because he knows that he's not going to persuade many swing voters to support him. His ticket to re-election, even more so than 2016, is to motivate his base to the highest level possible. And looking at the Clinton impeachment from the late 20th century as an antecedent, and knowing that he has a much more fervent base in his party than Clinton did in his, he believes if by refusing to provide witnesses, refusing to provide documents, this kind of this kind of behavior, if he can goad the Democrats into impeaching him, that will serve to motivate his most loyal supporters much more than anything else he could possibly do himself. If you look at the question of impeachment from a pure legal standpoint, there's a number of reasons now where it actually would provide a legal advantage to House Democrats. It helped them be able to get documents. So it helped them in other ways. So legally, it's beginning to make more and more sense. Politically, Trump wants it more and more. And while we're singing Pelosi's praises, let's take a moment to watch the way she has been exquisitely working her own Democratic caucus.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Including the most virulent supporters of impeachment. Because I don't think, and I'd be interested in your thought, Carla, I don't think the speaker is against impeaching Donald Trump. I think she's smart enough to understand that if the House does it, it has to do, it has to be in reaction to a whole series of actions or non-actions that will move a lot of the voters who currently don't think it's a good idea and to rush into it now when public opinion is so split.
Right. I completely agree with you there. And I think that's one other aspect of this crazy news conference today. You know, she, in the last couple of days, has been wrestling with her own caucus. About 30 of them are strongly supportive of impeachment. After today, you know, he's calling her Crazy Nancy, et cetera. They're going to be all totally behind her. So she, once again, controls the chessboard
But look at that. Yeah. Right now, there are roughly 30 Democrats who in the House who support impeachment. Last year at this time, there were two. I'm not very good at math.
Right.
But if you follow that trajectory, there are going to be thousands of House Democrats in favor of impeachment by this time next year.
Yeah.
Well, and Nancy Pelosi has her eye on the progressive wing, those candidates, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others, have been very vocal, and it's time, you know, we got elected, we the party needs to start doing what we say. But of course, more moderate Democrats flipped seats in the last election than these, you know, progressives who got elected in safe seats. So Pelosi is knowing that if she loses those moderate seats, she loses her speaker.
Yeah, and there's several of them in California. She's got to protect people like Katie Hill, Katie Porter, and so forth. They're in seats that are very dangerous for them. But I have to think that a lot of these impeachment advocates, like Ocasio-Cortez, watching what happened today with the Rose Garden and Trump, you know, going insane on Pelosi like he did, are going to stand behind her. And like, okay, let's calm, let's take a pass, let's chill out here.
And that's exactly right. She's not worried about her district here. She's worried about the swing districts. And I think that's one of the reasons she treats Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez with such disdain. It's not even disguised anymore. She treats Ocasio-Cortez the way we used to treat our pledges in my fraternity back in the day. She's just mean to her. And I think she's smart enough that I don't believe she's doing that just gratuitously, but is trying to send a message to other House progressives saying, it's not about my districts. It's not about the Bronx. It's about the swing districts that we just won that we got to keep.
Yeah.
Someone in the audience asks, will Californians realize that immigration will win the 2020 election for Donald Trump?
I don't know on that. I mean, when we have headlines like six children, migrant children have died in federal custody, Democrats are just starting to grab that and say, this cannot go on. There have been, in the last couple of weeks, stories showing children, you know, sleeping, migrant children sleeping in these deplorable conditions. Trump has not had to answer for this question. And there's one other question that I just keep wondering, when is some reporter going to ask him about, which is the fact that the Washington Post investigations about the many undocumented immigrants who work at his own properties. He has never been asked about that. And yet, even as he today talked again about the wall and it being built and so forth, and Democrats denied him funding when it came to this disaster bill on that. But the fact is that some of the issues related to the treatment of refugees and asylum seekers here have yet to be really fully investigated. And I think that issue, I agree that the issue of immigration, he has played that one, and it is very divisive. But I think many Americans are appalled by the idea of these children dying in federal custody, and he hasn't been held to account on.
I'm not as certain on this one as you are. I don't know the answer to the audience member's question, but I think it's a really smart question to ask. This goes back to something we said earlier. Neither party right now is really spending a lot of time talking to swing voters.
Yeah.
At this point in our history, winning elections has become about base motivation much more than persuading the voters in the middle. And you're right. Stories about those poor children motivate a lot of voters. Stories about an undocumented immigrant who commits a horrible crime motivate others.
And so I think, like abortion, I know we're going to talk about that also, should there be time, I'd suggest to you that issues like immigration and abortion, no one changes their mind. I'm trying to remember the last time I saw someone say, when I've been involved in discussion with them about either of those issues, for them to say, wait a minute, Dan, you're right. I've been wrong all these years.
Yeah, yeah.
I was lost and now I'm found. The scales have fallen from my eyes. Thank you so much for helping me see the light. I'm not maligning or making light of people with heartfelt opinions on either side of those issues. Just saying they're issues that tend to motivate people for their preferred candidate or preferred party rather than persuading. And Trump, just like on impeachment, understands that talking about this issue may motivate the Democrat base, but he's hoping, he's gambling that it'll motivate his base more. So I don't disagree with you, Carla. I'm just not as confident because I think it's a smart question that the individual raised.
Yeah. Well, it does get us to the issue about the states that have been passing some very strict abortion laws, curbing it, almost eliminating it, except in very, very rare circumstances. So it was the Alabama bill that I guess has been the most restrictive so far. And you've had a number of Republicans, including Pat Robertson, say, no, that's too far. Not meaning, they've changed their mind on abortion, but meaning the point of this is to get a bill to get to the U.S. Supreme Court that the Supreme Court will use to overturn Roe v. Wade. And if you send something that's too extreme, they're not going to, even this conservative court will not go for it. So this is a political roundtable, so we're not actually here to debate abortion.
Yeah.
But the politics of it, let's talk about.
Right.
And that is, both parties obviously think this is, again, going to the whole base thing, that this will generate their enthusiasm and get out the vote of their base. Who do you think's right?
I mean, this is an issue that I think has really fired up women voters and will fire up women voters. And it's one of those things, you saw the Women's March. That was this issue of defunding Planned Parenthood and now the Alabama abortion law is something that could really backfire. Even Trump, as you said, has said this is too extreme of a law. I've been covering, I was telling you, NARAL, a very well-known abortion rights, reproductive rights group, has had annual events here in San Francisco. Thousands of women turn out to these things. And for many years, the idea that Roe v. Wade would be overturned, was talked about, but never seriously. But now, women, and many women, at least in my generation, have never thought this would seriously happen, right? Because this has just been the law of the land. But now, with that law, it was kind of a wake-up call to a lot of, not just women voters, but I think people in the middle of the spectrum. And I think polls show a lot, most people are in the middle of the spectrum on this.
Well, I think this creates a real challenge for pro-life advocates. Because toward Carla's last point, primarily because of advances in technology, the pro-life movement has been making very gradual progress in recent years. Voters using this technology, sometimes changing their minds, sometimes supporting parental consent laws, sometimes talking about an earlier threshold at which abortion would be legal. So for the last many years, there's been a very slow, gradual movement in the pro-life direction, not in the on the broader question of whether abortion should be illegal or not, but these, for lack of a better term, sort of sub-issues. And this reverses that, because instead of a very slow, very gradual step toward an ultimate goal, this is a much more dramatic, much more aggressive one that's taken the likes of the RNC chair, the Republican congressional leaders, and Reverend Robertson to say too far. Married women decide elections in America. And this is the kind of thing, as Carla correctly pointed out, that could serve as a tremendous motivating force for female voters in the 2020 election. Should we have time, and John, I'll defer to you on this, we can talk a little bit about why married women are the most important people in America. Okay. All right. So you're all familiar with the gender gap, of course. Women tend to vote Democratic much more. Men tend to vote Republican much more. There's also an equally pronounced marriage gap. Married people tend to vote much more heavily Republican. Single people nationally tend to vote much more heavily Democrat. So what you've got then, you've got four basic quadrants. Way over here on the Democratic side, the most reliable Democratic voters are single women. One of my best friends is a single Republican man. He can't date in even numbered years because there are no single women to go out with him. Married men, not here in the city, but nationally,
tend to be the most reliable portion of the Republican base. Single men, and I was one for many years. I don't follow politics. We watch sports. We play Xbox. You know, we watch late night cable things. All jokes aside, single men are less attentive to politics than these other four cohorts, the three cohorts. And what that leaves you is married women. So for the married women in the audience, when you tell your spouse, when you tell your kids that you're the most important person in the world, you can say, I heard it at Commonwealth Club on Thursday night. In fact, I am the most important person in the world. And so when married women vote issues, they're commonly associated with marital status, primarily economic and criminal justice issues, they tend to vote for Republican candidates. When they vote on issues that are commonly and somewhat retro associated with gender characteristics, primarily cultural and social and environmental issues, they're more likely to vote Democratic. And moving this issue up onto the top tier, as Carlo was describing, could serve as a very powerful motivator for those married women next November.
Yeah. Well, on a very local level, San Francisco's public defender, Jeff Adagi, died a while ago, suddenly, unexpectedly. And a while later, a police report on the death came out that was talking about the conditions and the situation in which he was found dead. Very recently, there was a police raid, and I guess police and the FBI raided the home of a freelance journalist who had, I guess, had a copy of the report and was selling it to TV stations. Interestingly, I mean, Kamala Harris, Nancy Pelosi, to a lesser extent, Mayor London Breed have criticized the raid, though London Breed also took pains to point out that it was at a court order and it was legal and therefore appropriate. There are a lot of issues involved here. The public official, the journalist, the police, and both in the raid and whatever report was leaked and that kind of thing. Carly, you're a journalist.
This is the story that made national news because here you have the most liberal city in America and police busting down the door of a journalist and taking him away in handcuffs and seizing all his equipment. And yet, I think for the most part, San Francisco supervisors were pretty much silent on it. I didn't respond to comment on it. Even Mayor London Breed was sort of supportive of this idea. If this had happened, I have to say, it's been noted, if this had happened in Washington to a Trump official, I think we have a whole different reaction here in terms of how the press would react and how the government officials would react. There are a lot of complicated factors, as you said. The journalist involved got a hold of a police report that did not shine a good light on Jeff Adagi, who was, in many respects, a well-loved figure here, but who also died under some very questionable circumstances involving drugs, alcohol, etc. But this goes right to press freedom. We're talking about an era in which the president himself keeps calling the media the enemy of the people. And in San Francisco, they're taking away a reporter in handcuffs. For essentially, first of all, California has a shield law. Apparently, the judge involved didn't know that or didn't care. And it wasn't the reporter who broke the law in getting leaked information. We get leaked information all the time. They were trying to get to his source. He didn't want to reveal the source. Why more public officials here in San Francisco didn't express outrage to me is a shame, first of all. And I think we need more answers as to how this happened and whether it suggests that not just in Washington is there attack on free press, but also here in San Francisco.
I think that's right. First of all, Trump is going to use this. And he's going to use this to his benefit. The next time, or maybe not the next time, but soon, when he is criticized for his treatment of the press and using words like any of the people, enemy of the people, and fake news and that sort of thing, he's going to say, hey, look what they did in liberal San Francisco. I might call them names, but I don't bust down their doors and do all these things. So he, mark my words, he is going to make an issue out of this at the earliest or best opportunity. Second, I think more broadly, look, Thomas Jefferson once said, given the choice between a government without a free press or a free press without a government, I would not hesitate to choose the latter. And, not to preach here, and I apologize if it comes across this way. Look, the First Amendment's hard. The First Amendment's really, really hard. It's easy to defend the First Amendment rights of someone with whom you agree. it's really, really hard to stand there and grit your teeth to let someone who speaks up on behalf of something that you disdain, that you despise, because they have a First Amendment right to say it. I grew up in the Midwest, not too far from where John did, in Wisconsin, which is not only close to Indiana, but it's close to Skokie, Illinois. And all of you are familiar with the landmark case in Skokie, Illinois. I will tell you this. My grandparents, I was young, I was still a kid. My grandparents took me to Skokie because they wanted me to see it. They wanted me to see even people standing up for things that we despised, exercising a right to free speech that we don't take away from people. That's just not what we do.
And for those who don't remember that case, this was a matter where neo-Nazis wanted to march through Skokie, Illinois, Skokie being a heavily Jewish suburb of Chicago.
And they were, as the Supreme Court allowed them to march because they had the First Amendment rights to even say horrible, hateful things. And while I'm not a native of San Francisco, I have followed this story up here very, as closely as I can. Although I must admit, Carla, I cannot make heads or tails of Mayor Breed's statement on this. I have no idea what she thinks about this as much as I try. Yeah. But what it appears from a distance is deciding that the First Amendment rights that a free press enjoys only go as far as when it causes political inconvenience. And I hope once some understandably impassioned, understandably distraught political and civic and community leaders have a chance to take their breath, catch their breath and take a step back, that they'll say, I might have reacted badly in those first days. But ultimately, we have to do everything we can to protect the free press, even if they are pursuing stories that we would rather that they did not.
Okay. Someone in the audience asks about, you mentioned Representative Katie Porter from California, who quizzed Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson, asked him if he knew what REO was. He thought she said Oreo. I'm just glad he didn't hear REO and respond Speedwagon. You have to be a certain generation, I guess, to get that one.
And another Midwestern.
Exactly. It was a band. But what did you think about it? I'll be honest, I had a mixed reaction to that. And one, I know housing policy. That used to be what I used to report on, so I knew what REO was. I know a lot about HUD and all that kind of stuff. And he does not come across as being an expert on it. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
At the same time, it seemed, you know, she did this and immediately she was pushing out the video of it and kind of running a victory lap. Like, I've just shown how stupid this person is.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking that if that were flipped around and that were a Republican doing that to a Democrat,
I think in the age of social media, that's where we're at. That is the way elected officials deliver their message. And she got a tremendous amount of attention. And you're right. You know, as brilliant as a neurosurgeon as Ben Carson is, it's very clear he doesn't know some of the basics of his job. And I think that was of such a visual, you know, she's in a very tough seat down there. She's got to work it. She's got to do everything she can to get her constituents to know. And this is where we're at. Social media is how they do it.
Yeah. But I'd say this. Members of Congress of both parties have used committee hearings to embarrass opposing witnesses for decades, for generations. That's, for better or worse, one reason why those committee hearings take place, to expose either a lack of knowledge or the indefensibility of an individual's position. That said, I think the member of Congress comes off much better herself or himself when they do it on a matter of substance. So Representative Porter, earlier this year, was questioning Jamie Dimon, the finance industry leader, and pressed him just as hard on questions of compensation for his own employees. I don't think that he was any more or less embarrassed than the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development was this week. But I think Porter came out of it looking much better because she focused that attention and created that confrontation on a matter of policy rather than personality.
One last question from the audience, and this is really back to our Trump discussion. Who was the last candidate to win the presidency during a booming economy? I mean, the Democrat, if Trump didn't have so many probably self-created problems, he probably would be sailing to re-election. Booming economy, incumbent.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, who was the last president who did not win re-election during a booming economy?
Who was the last challenger to beat an incumbent during a booming economy?
Hmm.
we could make this the first quiz question.
Yeah. But I think the point certainly is that you got to put, you know, with all the other things we were talking about earlier about his willingness, he's very wily.
And we've already seen Joe Biden sort of try to take credit for the booming economy
I'll take the question and answer it in a somewhat unfair way. In fact, by the time of the 1992 election, the U.S. economy had begun to recover very considerably, but George H.W. Bush was still defeated for re-election. The question of a thriving as opposed to a recovering economy.
Yeah.
Look, there were no shortage of Republicans who believed that Donald Trump's surest path to re-election would be to go to Mar-a-Lago, take away his Twitter account, and just sit there for the next 18 months and not say anything in public and just let the economy continue upward, and he would almost certainly be reelected. I think the questioner's point is, is the same.
Okay, well, on that note, let's go to our news quiz. I'll ask a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. Only after I call on you, please raise your hand. Otherwise, we have multiple people answering, and someone doesn't get chocolate.
Hey, John.
Yes.
Lyndon Johnson didn't lose, but he withdrew. Even though the American economy in the late 60s was very
strong. True. It was, in fact, the economy was red hot.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
First question. What country's leader held what was described as the most expensive dinner in the country, at which guests paid $173,000 each to attend? Did anyone see the story? I'll give you a hint. It's in Africa.
That was the Biden fundraiser, right?
Nobody saw that one?
Wow.
Okay. It was Ethiopia, actually. It was a fundraiser to
Ethiopia.
Well, these were businessmen and women, and they were paying money. The money went to revitalize a part of the capital city. So went to a good cause.
Right.
Well, speaking of money, with a monthly average of $6,526, San Francisco now has the nation's highest what? Sir?
Rent?
No, but good question. Way in back. That's correct.
That is correct. Yeah.
That is the average monthly salary in San Francisco.
Yes. San Francisco knocked off Zurich, by the way.
Did it?
Yes. For highest average salary, right.
Okay. So the so-called American Taliban has left federal prison as of today. What is his name? Over there, sir? That's right. John Walker Lind.
From Marin County.
Gentleman over here in the front row in the middle. Yes. And he's not returning immediately to Marin.
There's no housing.
there's no housing.
So we've heard President Trump call Joe Biden Sleepy Joe. Now, who is calling Biden, quote, an imbecile bereft of elementary quality as a human being and a fool of low IQ, unquote, right there in front? North Korea, that is correct.
Whoa.
They have the best insults. If I ever become president, all I care about is finding out what they're going to call me. We're unsure if Sarah Palin could really see Russia from her house in Alaska, but this week she might very well have seen Russian what from her home?
Oh.
Ma'am, that's right, fighter jets. Russian fighter jets were repeatedly encroaching on U.S. airspace there.
Right.
And they were met by American fighter jets. That's what happens. They found not one, but three wills in the home of what recently deceased singer right there in the second row?
Aretha
Franklin, that is correct. Hmm. If your loved ones die in the state of Washington, what can you now do to them, sir? You can compost them.
Oh!
Coming soon to Berkeley, I'm sure. Okay. What former governor was attacked at a sporting event in South Africa? Sir, right there on the edge? Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right, yeah.
Someone basically tried to drop kick him and knocked him over and he was...
Did they succeed?
They succeeded. Actually, it's worth looking at his Twitter account of it. I thought he handled it really well.
Yeah, he did, actually.
He was saying, look, if you're gonna share the video, I understand it, but use this video because it doesn't show the idiot. Don't give the kicker because it was just some... So shareholders lost two votes intended to change Amazon's policies toward what controversial technology? In fact, San Francisco doesn't like this technology. Way in back in the red?
Facial recognition.
That's right. Facial recognition technology. In particular, selling it to police departments. Today, the United States filed, I've seen 17, I've also seen 18, Espionage Act charges against whom? Way in back, sir. Julian Assange. Now the question, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is delaying until 2026 or 2028, placing who on the $20 bill? Ma'am, back there in the white. Harriet Tubman, yes. For perhaps the first time in history, people are actually paying attention to elections this weekend for what multinational organization?
EU.
Sir, right there, I think in the second row? The EU, that's right, the European Parliament elections. We'll have lots more to talk about and, of course, more news quiz questions the next time we meet here. I want to thank our great panel, Dan Schnur and Carla Marinucci. Thank you. Thanks to all of you here in the room and everyone watching and listening online. Have a great weekend.